We both looked at the grass. There is a sharp line where my ragged lawn ended and the darker, well-kept expanse of his began. F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby. We all know the feeling of laying in a freshly cut plot of grass, each blade tickling our skin as tiny insects make their way closer. Backyard barbecues, carefree games of fetch with human's best friend, and afternoon rounds of golf all take the stage atop a sea of green. It's the setting we all know and love, and a picturesque image of happiness. But just as we see in The Great Gatsby, the American lawn has come to represent so much more than just grass. Gatsby becomes so embarrassed and appalled by Nick Carraway's lack of lawn maintenance that he volunteers his own expenses to cut Carraway's grass and pick his weeds, just to achieve a perfectly green, perfectly crisp grass carpet in the vicinity of his house, not just his front lawn. Fitzgerald didn't include this as a witty aside. He included it because it's an all too real representation of the societal pressure to achieve the American dream, a cookie-cutter suburban house with a white picket fence and an overtly impeccable lawn. And yet, that image is one that is slowly destroying not only the very resources it relies on, like the environment and its processes, but is contributing to the pollution that makes our water undrinkable and our air unbreathable. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, in the United States, lawns consume nearly 3 trillion gallons of water a year and 70 million pounds of pesticides, in addition to the 800 million gallons of gas used for mowing. That's a lot of water that could have been consumed by dehydrated humans, a lot of chemicals running off into healthy water sources, and a lot of greenhouse gases released into the atmosphere, all to achieve a socially constructed image of perfection. So how did we get here? Why is the idea of a nicely weeded, freshly cut grass meadow so illustrious? Well, its origins lie outside the houses of 17th century wealthy English landowners who used the lawn as a mark of high wealth and status. Instead of using their grazing land for grazing, they spent their money on workers who would weed and trim by hand their grass lawns. European grass seeds were then, of course, sailed across the ocean blue and planted in North America. With the rise of industrialization, the first lawnmower was created, making lawns more accessible to the middle class. Then, along with Scottish immigrants, came the largest benefactor to the rise of the grass lawn and the beginning of our paradoxical conflict between recreation and environmental protection, golf. The first American golf course was built in 1888 in New York, creating an opportunity for growing commercial turf grass, a crop which produces nothing actually edible for any creature, as its intended use is to provide a viable rolling surface for a plastic ball. The game of golf immediately took off in the U.S. as we entered 70 players in the 1904 Olympics and created the U.S. Golf Association, who helped research the most effective ways to grow grass in partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. While it seems like a positive recreational use of land, providing adequate habitats for wildlife, the construction and maintenance of golf courses can have shockingly detrimental effects on all aspects of a natural area. Deforestation destroys natural habitats of tree-dwelling creatures, fungi, and insects. It increases soil erosion and runoff sediment loads and renders the land more prone to the effects of both wind and water erosion. For example, during construction of the Keopuka Lands Golf Course and Resort in Hawaii, runoff carried multiple tons of dirt, depositing it off the coast in an at-risk coral reef ecosystem. In addition to the physical sculpting of the earth, golf courses require extreme quantities of chemical pesticides and fertilizers in order to maintain their almost eerie, vibrant green. A study by the Journal of Pesticide Reform found that an average of 750 kilograms of pesticides are sprayed on a typical 18-hole golf course each year. Another study found that number to be 1,500 kilograms, with 90% of sprayed chemicals ending up in the air, And even another study found that number to be 22,680 kilograms of both dry and liquid chemicals. Whichever number you choose to trust, these statistics are not good. Nutrient runoff causes harmful algal blooms that kill fish and release toxins into the atmosphere, pollute our groundwater and drinking water supplies, and kill non-target species that encounter them. The chemicals used on golf courses aren't the only ones that find their way to unintended locations. Residential lawn chemicals not only run off in the same locations as golf courses, but given their close proximity to the home, they can make their way to extremely human-sensitive locations. With 83.9% of U.S. households applying chemical fertilizers and 63.8% applying insecticides to their lawns, these toxins even accumulate in house dust, especially carpets, posing a threat to all inhabitants, small children in particular. In the 1920s, though, chemical grass treatments had yet to be developed, so turf grass cultivation remained rather natural. Industrialization and urbanization brought city beautification campaigns that introduced the park, inspired by British estate grounds, and Frederick Law Olmsted, the quote-unquote father of landscape architecture, made common the backyard lawn as an antidote of sorts to increasing urbanization. The 50s saw the boom in lawn presence, made possible by primarily three events: the development of the first cookie-cutter suburb named Levittown, the need for affordable housing to accommodate families and returning war soldiers, who, by the way, had been trained in precision, conformity, and neatness, and lastly, the technological developments of the rotary lawnmower, chemical pesticide, and the first weed-free grass seeds. The combination of these events transformed the lawn from a symbol of wealth to a symbol of the middle-class American dream. Following World War II, media persisted in spreading the message that suburban properties must quote-unquote showcase a well-kept and well-fed lawn. Even publications like Better Homes and Gardens hopped on the bandwagon, lining up experts to aid in advising homeowners of proper lawn care duties. These new standards incentivized the research and production of massive quantities of lawn chemicals, easily marketed and sold to innocent consumers attempting to achieve the post-war American dream. So here we are, surrounded by seas of soft, velvety grass, not a weed in sight and not a blade to tickle above my ankle. Is this really the American dream? Have we done it? Or were we coerced to believe it would be? The neighbor you see mowing their lawn every weekend is just one of about 54 million Americans who also mow their lawn every weekend, emitting high levels of carbon monoxide, volatile organic compounds, and carbon dioxide, producing up to 5% of the U.S.'s air pollution alone. In a recent National Water Quality Assessment, the U.S. Geological Survey detected one or more species in 99% of urban stream samples. Is this the grandness that individuals like Jay Gatsby hoped for? Dirty air, polluted waters, and dying species? While our monocultural culture still persists, there are small changes we can make to both how we treat our grass and what we grow altogether. First, watering grass effectively according to weather patterns and topography can greatly reduce the amount of wasted water and runoff. Second, ditching chemicals for natural fertilizers like coffee grounds or compost and pest management strategies can decrease the excessive nutrient load placed on grasses, most of which ends up in waterways anyway. And third, after mowing your lawn using an electric or non-petrol burning lawnmower, leave the grass clippings to mulch on the lawn, helping to return nutrients to the soil, retain soil moisture, and act as an effective carbon sink. If you're ready to make the leap to a lawn alternative, try low-growing ground covers like chamomile, thyme, clover, ground ivy, creeping jenny, or even moss. All of these are low maintenance, requiring no or very little trimming, little watering, and no fertilizers or pest control. Remember to do your own research before choosing a species, though, as growing a non-native species in your area is not only difficult, but damaging to the soil microbiome. The best way to incorporate a grass-free lawn is to use either seeds or plots of pre-grown single-species trays and create a mosaic. This planting method allows for landscape design, often referred to as tapestry lawns, for their quilt-like patterning, which draws the eye in along with various pollinators and clever insects. Of course, you could always protest the idea of the lawn altogether and start a vegetable, herb, or flower garden in your yard and make all of your neighbors jealous as you pluck your own fresh blueberries and eat them straight from the bush. Frederick Law Olmsted once said, "The enjoyment of scenery employs the mind without fatigue and yet exercises it, tranquilizes it and yet enlivens it, and thus, through the influence of the mind over the body, gives the effect of refreshing rest and reinvigoration to the whole system." Essentially, pretty sights work the mind in a way that both exercises and relaxes it to physically rejuvenate the human body. It is this sensation that we so yearn for, but we're stuck in a system that's shrinking the number of opportunities to feel it. So the next time your bare feet meet the soft bristles of a grass lawn, and your eyes glaze over a field of individual green blades, try stepping away from our ingrained Gatsby ideals and search for any imperfections you can find, be it a dandelion, a single uncut blade, or a tiny yellow flower we might consider a weed, admiring it for its courage, its capacity, and its constant battle with society's need for ugly perfection.